It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
50 years ago, March 1971, the Kentucky State Thoroughbreds were wrapping up their second of three consecutive NAIA National Championships. Arthur Box had just finished up his senior year of high school in Cleveland. He came to Frankfort the following season when the Thoroughbreds remained on top of the NAIA basketball world with a third straight title. In the years since, he has become sort of an unofficial historian for that great era, and he has written a book called Still Champions After All These Years, a compilation of biographies, photos, and statistics of the championship teams and others from the coaching tenure of Lucius Mitchell, when there was NBA talent on the floor for the Thoroughbreds and very often for their opponents as they played in front of packed houses on the campus in Frankfort. To say it was a great atmosphere at the games is a great understatement. Arthur Box played on the national championship team of 1972 and NAIA district champions in 1972, 73, 74, and 75. He scored 958 points in his career at Kentucky State, which placed him, at that time, 19th on the Thoroughbred scoring list. And we'll talk to him today about that legendary era in Kentucky State basketball. Arthur, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Before we look back on those years, tell us where you are currently in your life. You've made your home in Frankfort, I know, for a long time, but tell us what's keeping you busy these days.
Well, I am a grandfather of four grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I've been happily married to my wife. It'll be like 43 years this year. I currently work for the Transportation Cabinet as a transportation engineering technician, three. And with the COVID going on, we're working from the home office.
Mm-hmm. But still active and staying busy and enjoying good health and enjoying those grandchildren. That is great. And I know you like getting together with your former teammates when you can, too. And I wanted to ask you about how all those great teams came together. We sometimes think of, if we look out on the basketball floor and see these star players, we think of guys who maybe were practically born with a basketball in their hand. But everybody has a different story about how they began to focus on basketball. And in your case, the competition, you might say, was music, and in particular performing in a band there in Cleveland where you grew up. Tell me about those days.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was tested early and had a high musical aptitude, so I was selected to play an instrument, and I played a violin for about 5 years, and then my father bought me a set of drums, and he bought me a bass guitar, and to make a long story short, a lady threw a talent show in our neighborhood, and these guys formed a singing group, and they needed a drummer. And so they asked me if I would play, and I guess I made the cut. I made the group, and we were highly successful. We took a old the Temptations used to be called the Primes. When they vacated that name, we took that name, the Primes, and we were highly successful in Cleveland as far as singing groups were concerned. And things were swimming along pretty good until I was in eighth grade, and I was about 6 foot tall, and I started playing basketball, and my other friends was encouraging me to play basketball. And my dad wanted me to further my education in college. And I convinced him that if I was good enough to play basketball, I could get a scholarship and go to college. And he wouldn't have to pay anything. I could, basketball could pay my way. Mm-hmm. And so he was skeptical, but he allowed me to do it. And so I had to prove to him that I could be good enough to play college basketball or go to college based on my basketball skills.
So you had to make the choice to really focus on basketball at that time. And as a result, you had some options coming out of high school, as I understand it, Western Michigan, Brown University, and some others. How did Kentucky State win out over those schools?
Well, I tell you what, Yeah, I did have quite a few options. All of the local schools there in Cleveland, like Case Western Reserve, Cleveland State, Kent State, a lot of those, Baldwin Wallace, a lot of those schools were interested in me. But a funny thing happened. I used to be in the Upward Bound program at Case Western Reserve, and one of my good friends was in this program, and he was a basketball player for an arch rival school called East Tech. And so he said, hey, the coach from Kentucky State is coming to see me play, so why don't you come with me? So me and another guy real close to us named Cashmere Moss, we went up to Fairfax just to play, you know. So the ironic thing, though, after we got through playing, the coach from Kentucky State wasn't interested in him. He was interested in me, and he was interested in Cashmere. Uh-huh. So he told us he'd be getting back in touch with us, and lo and behold, he offered us a scholarship to go to Kentucky State.
Well, there was a lot of winning going on at Kentucky State at the time. Were you aware of the program's success at that time before any of the recruitment, or was this all new to you as you began to be recruited?
Well, there was a couple of ball players from Cleveland on that team. There was a point guard by the name of Jerome Brister. Mm-hmm. There was another went to East Tech High School, one of our arch rivals here in Cleveland. And then there was another fellow by the name of Jared Stafford. He was also a point guard at East Tech. And then they had a big 6'6 power forward named Leon Harris from East Tech. So I knew I wasn't going there totally alone. I knew that they had some good ball players there, and I knew that they were winning. So I wasn't totally in the dark, but my eyes were still open when I got there. But when I got there, you know, you had to be there. You couldn't tell a story about what you saw. You really needed to see it.
It was a great atmosphere. And what were your impressions? Do you recall as you maybe you entered the gym for the first time or attended a game there as a high school senior? What were the impressions that were made on you?
Well, I tell you, you wouldn't believe it. Well, they had the greatest score, I believe, personally, that ever played basketball in Travis Grant. Mm-hmm. He shot 70% from the field, and I'm not talking about layups and dunks.
No.
I mean, these were just stops. Yeah. And then they had Elmore Smith, who you know, mm-hmm. 7-footer. Those two guys were so prolific. Travis wouldn't miss anything, and if another guy shot and missed, Elmore got all the shots, all the rebounds for the most part. And then he blocked. He was averaging about 16 and 17 blocks a game. Block shot. I mean, he kept the basket clean for about 5 or 10 minutes. The other team couldn't get a shot off. I mean, he was blocking jump shots from the corner, from the top of the key. He was just amazing. And at that time, every time the team would perk up and do something, they had a jazz band over in the corner that would rev up and start playing while the team was playing.
Right.
And that atmosphere, you can't, like I said, you had to be there to see it, because you wouldn't believe it. It was so, the school atmosphere, the team, the school atmosphere was so great. The school spirit, that's what I'm trying to say. The school spirit was so great, it just made you want to be a part of it.
And that was at, is it Bell Gymnasium right there on campus? Was that,
yeah,
am
that
I
was
correct?
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. I attended a game in the 70-71 season when Kentucky State played Tennessee State, and of course Tennessee State days had Ted McLean and Lloyd Neal and Leonard Truck Robinson, and of course Kentucky State had Travis Grant and Elmore Smith, and I remember the place being packed and just excitement from start to finish. And of course these were two of the top teams, very top teams in NAIA. Tennessee State was a huge rival of Kentucky State at that time, and the atmosphere really is incomparable. I can certainly see why you'd say that You just about have to experience it to know what it was like at that time. But now, in addition to the great spirit at Kentucky State, of course, you had to determine that, that Lucius Mitchell and you would be a good fit and that you could play for him. What about his coaching or approach convinced you that he was the coach you wanted to play for?
Well, I know he was a disciplinarian, but it really wasn't about playing for a coach. What it really was about was the team, the camaraderie that we had as a team. Mm-hmm. When I came there to visit there, that unit, they were so tight and so close-knit that, I mean, they were a family. And it kind of made you want to be a part of it. I mean, they were so close. You know, when you work for a strict disciplinarian like Coach Mitchell or like Bobby Knight, you know how it is. The team kind of sticks together, you know. And when I saw that camaraderie, I wanted to be a part of that because it wasn't just that they were good basketball players that made you want to come, but they were good friends. They were a tight-knit group from the first man to the last man. And as Travis and Elmore would tell you, I mean, they were the main stars. But as they would tell you, they were a team because everybody had a job and everybody did their job. And, I mean, they were so close-knit, I said, man, I got to be a part of this.
And that's evidenced by the fact that you all have stayed close through these years with all those reunions. If you were just playing to play basketball at that time, probably you would have gone your separate ways and maybe not gotten in touch as much as you have. But that the reunions have become a big part of your celebration of those championships through the years. And I do want to ask you about those a little bit later, but a little bit more about Coach Mitchell. He was 72-28 at Alabama State, and then at Kentucky State, his first year, he had to do some building. He was 10-15, but then over his 8 years at Kentucky State, he was at 193 wins and 47 losses. So once he got it going, those teams were, to borrow Travis Grant's nickname, they were really a machine, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, we had some outstanding basketball players. At the time, you know, we were Division I basketball players. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those schools wasn't recruiting African-Americans. And so he got some ball players in there from Alabama. And I'm sure you heard of Billy Ray Bates.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had Gerald Cunningham, Lewis Linder, Roy Smith. So these guys were all-state, all-Americans in their respective states, and they all came to Kentucky State. And so we had some outstanding basketball players. And what Coach Mitchell did, 80% of our practices were defense. So we played a tenacious man-to-man defense and then a 2-2-1 zone trap. And we ran the fast break every time we got the ball. You know, I don't know if you remember those Arkansas teams where Nolan Richardson coached, and they would say 40 minutes of hell.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Well, they got that from Coach Mitchell, who probably got it from one of his predecessors back in the day, but that's how we played the game. We didn't run and shoot, but we played tenacious defense. And we fast break every time we got a chance. And as a result, we had the ball players that just really knew how to play the game. And Coach really, he put the ball players out on the front. Again, I'm saying he was a strict disciplinarian. Because if he said he only wanted the layup, then that's what you shot. You didn't fall back and shoot something from the corner or something like that. You did exactly what Coach said. But the point was, that's why we won, because we paid attention.
Yeah. Do you remember any particularly memorable pregame or halftime talk from Coach Mitchell? Any time when he had to address a particular issue or some game that maybe was not going well for you, where he had to get you back on focus at halftime? what was it like in the locker room?
where he had to chew us out. Well, I remember one game where we were playing Kentucky Wesleyan, and they had an outstanding team. I think Kentucky Wesleyan was ranked number one in the nation at the time.
Yeah, they had a lot of powerhouse teams in those days. Yeah,
but we were coming up the ladder because we started out slow that year, but we was in the middle of a 24 game winning streak. We was in the middle of that, and so when we played Kentucky Wesleyan, and they had these two point guards that were averaging about 24, 25 a game. So at halftime, we were down by 10 points. And Coach came in there. He chewed us a new one. But then he told us, he said, gentlemen, you're stinking up the place, and you're only down by 5 baskets. And so when we came out there the second half, we wound up winning that game about 10 points. But Coach brought a guy off of the bench. We called him Harold Daniels. His name was Hand. He had real big hands. And he wasn't a regular starter, and he very rarely got into the rotation. But Coach put him in there. He went 10 for 11 from what would be now called a three-point shot. We didn't have a three-point shot then. He went 10 for 11. We wound up beating Kentucky Wesleyan by about 10 or 15 points. And their coach said that was a three-ring circus, and how could anybody play in that place because of the jazz band and all of the stuff that was going on?
Uh-huh.
We really just came out and routed them. But Coach, he would always tell us where we were. He'd chew us in the – we didn't want to lose. And we rarely lost. We lost 18 games, at least in my tenure. We lost 18 games in 4 years. And so we every time we stepped on the floor, we thought we was going to win that game. That's the way we approached it. We always thought we was going to win. And that was built in our psyche to win.
You talked about the defense, the tenacious defense, and the press. That 70-71 team with Elmore Smith and Travis Grant averaged 103 points a game. But as you say, they got a lot of that with steals, no doubt, and fast breaks. It wasn't. I mean, Travis Grant could really pour it in from outside, but it sounds like it was a team effort in the sense that that tough defense really turned into a lot of offensive opportunities to put up that many points in a ball game.
It really did. I can tell you, my senior year, we played Alabama State. And Alabama State had an outstanding team. Halftime, I think the score was around 50 to 50. And so the second half, the first 5 minutes of the game, our defensive pressure was so tight that we went up on them about 15 points within a span of 5 minutes. And we had a fellow on the team, you're on the foul line and the guys are trying to spur their players on, the Alabama State players. And the guy kept saying, come on, man, we can come back. And one of my teammates, Lewis Leonard, looked at him in the face. He said, buddy, it's over. Ain't no coming back. And so when I heard him say that, I cracked up because he was telling the truth. They wasn't coming back. We beat them like 125 to 75. They never really got their feet up under them again. So I don't know if you remember the Louisville team with Daryl Griffin and those guys when they won the national championship.
Yeah, that was
1980. Mm-hmm. The 80-10. You remember how they would get a spurt and they go up about 20 points in like 5 or 10 minutes. All of a sudden they blew the game up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's the way we were. You know, a team could play with us. They could play with us for like the first 10 minutes. And we had tremendous defensive pressure on them, but you know, they were fresh, but we were in such physical condition that we kept that same defensive pressure for the whole game. And after a while, with about 10 minutes left in the game, they would get tired. And so those crisp, sharp passes that they were making, all we did was step into the passing lane, and they were throwing us the ball because our defense is not designed to steal the ball. It's just designed to keep pressure. But if you play the passing lanes, they wind up giving you the ball because the passes weren't as crisp. They was tired. They wasn't focused. And we were just fast break. Before you know it, the game was over. And so that's the kind of we had to be in tremendous shape because we ran all the time. And so we knew that we was in better shape than any team that we came across.
We've talked a lot about Travis Grant and Elmore Smith, but Grant in particular, 4,045 points for his college career, a record for college basketball, and just about 400 more than Pete Maravich scored at LSU, and that was in basically that same general time period. And Grant scored 33 points a game for his career. When you're watching a game now and a team is hitting its three-point shots and seems to be really hot and someone is referred to as a great shooter, it must be hard for you not to think of Travis Grant and what kind of records he might have set with a three-point shot in effect at that time.
Well, I always make the statement, if they'd had the three-point shot when Travis was playing, Travis probably would have had about 6,000 or 7,000 points.
Yeah.
Because I saw, you know, you hear the rumors about how great somebody is, and oh man, this guy can really play. You know, I'm coming out of high school, and I feel I can play too. But the first game that I saw Travis play, he hit 56 points. The next game that we played, he hit 40 points. The next game we played, he hit 54 points. And when he wasn't they want to say he was gunning, he shot all the time. If Travis shot the ball 30 times, he hit like 24 shots. Or if he shot the ball 35 times, he hit 25 shots. The year that he scored the 75 points, he took 50 shots, but he hit 35 of them. So, I mean, he was a pure shooter. You never really saw, and he didn't gun. You know, he took what was there, and so. We went out when we played George Gervin for Eastern Michigan. You probably heard this story. We played George Gervin for Eastern Michigan. George Gervin was averaging about 39 a game. He was this big hot shot ball player, and so he was checking Travis. Travis had 18 points the first half of the game. The second half, he hit 50 points, and that one stretch, he shot 18 straight without missing.
Wow.
And he wound up with 68 points. And George Gervin was begging the coach to take them off him because he couldn't stop it. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And I mean, you had to be an eyewitness. I witnessed that game. And when we went out to Kansas City, our first game in the NAIA tournament, Travis wound up with 60 points. And again, he went like 18 straight. Point guard stole a ball. And he could have just made a layup, but Travis was trailing him. He stopped under the basket, kicked the ball back out to Travis. Travis stopped at the top of the key, took a shot, and went all net, and he got a standing ovation from the crowd. It was about 10,000 people there. They all stood up because they had never seen anything like that. That's the kind of ball player. I mean, he was great. But he was the humblest guy in the room. He would hit 60 points. You never know it if you saw him in the room. He wasn't beating his chest and head big and walking out of line like he owned everything. You wouldn't even know he was there. He was so humble, you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, if one guy is taking that many shots, that's a potential to be possibly a divisive element on the team. But his track record was so good, and as you say, he was such a good teammate. Everybody just kind of went along with his success, and we're glad to be part of it, it sounds like.
Well, this is the thing. You got a guy that can hit 7 out of 10 shots. Who you going to pass the ball to?
Right.
I shot 50% from the field, but you got somebody hitting 70%. I mean, common sense tells you got to get him the ball. And we understood that. And it was no jealousy because we did other things. I figured that the three shots that Travis missed, I was going to get the rebound. and put it back in. That was my philosophy. So I said, he can't make them all. When he missed that, I'm going to get it. So,
yeah.
So that was our philosophy. And Travis was so humble, though. And to this day, he is still the most humblest person you ever wanted to meet in your life. You know, when we have our reunions, Travis always does the fish fry. He'll do the fish fry, and he waits on everybody. He kind of making sure everybody's okay. You know, he's just a great person.
I wanted to ask you about the competition. We talked about at that time, of course, late 60s, early 70s, Kentucky had good teams. Western had some great teams in the late 60s, and U of L was before Denny Crum, but still had some outstanding players. And as you mentioned before, because a lot of the teams, bigger schools in the South, had not really gotten much done in the way of integration at that point, a lot of the great ball players were still going to smaller schools. And so you and your teammates, as I understand it, were pretty confident about your ability to compete with teams at any level of college basketball, and certainly the number of NBA players that were on the floor at that time would indicate that. But I heard about some pickup games. Were there some pickup games against some of the UK players and maybe others from other schools? Do you recall that?
Well, that was kind of before my time, but the guys used to go over to UK and they would play pickup games with Wes Unsell, Elmore, Travis, and those guys. The team before me, Joe B. Hall, he found out about it and he stopped it from happening. But they used to go over there all the time, and they held their own. They used to wear them out, you know, but, you know, that was kind of behind closed doors, so they would say my word against theirs, or you know how it goes.
Sure.
But we did have a desire to play. We figured we could play against anybody, you know, because if you look at the NAIA program as a whole, some of the greatest NBA players came from the NAIA.
Yes.
You know, you had Will Reed that played for the Knicks. Well, he went to Grambling.
Mm-hmm.
Grambling was an NAIA school. You had Cornbread Maxwell went to Maryland Eastern Shores. So you had, I could go on naming some of these guys, but they came out of the NAIA. And, you're talking about, it was a grueling tournament. You had to play 5 games in 5 days or 5 games in 6 days. And, you know, there was no time for rest. You know, you have one game one night, you win, you play the next night, you play the next night. They crowned the champion within a week. And so that's how grueling that tournament was.
I wanted to ask you about travel in those days and in your college years, because the on-the-road time is usually the time when you get to know your teammates the best. But what was travel like for you at the NAIA level in the early 1970s?
We had a good time. We used to drive in these minivans. We had 2 minivans that we – but basically driving. When we played teams that were close, like Central State of Ohio, or we played teams down in Tennessee or in Kentucky or Indiana, we would always take those minivans. But if we ever went out of state substantially, we would fly out, you know. If we played, I can't think of the school in Pennsylvania, or we played in Missouri, like Lincoln, Missouri. We had to fly out there to play Lincoln, Missouri, in Jefferson City, Missouri, or down at Alabama State or a place like that. We couldn't drive there. We would fly. But, we didn't have the budget to do a lot of that type of thing. And so you're talking about the camaraderie on the minivans. We had a great time. You know, we was always together talking stuff, listening to the radio, Randy's record, Mark. We were listening to what the latest songs were at night. And, you know, so we always had a real good time, particularly if we won. Now, if we didn't win, it was a quiet trip on the way back.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be dreading practice the next day because Coach would work us Canada. He would work us out pretty hard, you know, because he didn't like to lose. He really didn't. And so we was always trying to win because practice was the hardest thing that we had to do. When we played games, we had actually rested because practice, we were playing against some of the toughest ball players in the country, and they was on our team.
Yeah.
So practice was grueling, and we actually relaxed during the game because we figured that we was better than anybody we was going to play. And, you know, so it was always pretty intense in practice.
Is there anyone that maybe stands out or a practice session, if you recall maybe a tough loss and the quiet ride home followed by practice the next day, is there any particular game that maybe falls in that category that stands out to you at this point?
No, not really. We would work so hard. Sometimes sometimes he'd give us the day off because of the travel would take so much out of us. But he would rest us a day after a real grueling practice. But so we didn't really have anything like. But we knew when we did get into practice, we knew it was going to be tough. Because we lost. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, changes might be made. The lineup might change a little bit or somebody messed up or, you know, what it was. The lineup could change a little. And so we was always on our P's and Q's. No matter how good you thought you were, Coach Mitchell, when we warmed up before a game, he would always call out the lineup when we go back in after the shoot-around. And then that's when you know who's going to start the game because nothing was like, I got this made. Whether you know, he would always call that lineup out. And sometimes that lineup would change, you know. So, but, you know, you didn't hold no grudges because you know that anybody the coach put in there, they could play some basketball.
Right.
Yeah. So you just do your job when you got in there and show the man that he should have confidence in you to play because you know how to play the game. That was my whole focus when I was a freshman. You know, you come to a school and you got a lot of accolades. You was all sitting, you did all this, you did all that. Well, everybody on the team did all of that. So what you have to do is show coach that when you get in a game time situation, you could play. And then he wouldn't hesitate to call your number no matter what the circumstances was on the game. If he put you in, then he had confidence that you could do the job. And that's the whole thing, you know. So you just had to continue to demonstrate to coach that you could play the game. And he'd call your number. You know, he didn't play favorites. That's the thing about Coach Mitchell. He never played favorites. You know, he had favorite players, but even if he didn't like you or if he gave you a hard time, on the crunch time, he would always put you in. He'd be, you know, because he didn't play favorites, he was a winner.
Well, you are a member of the Kentucky State Athletics Hall of Fame, as are several of your teammates from that era. And as I mentioned earlier, you'd remain close all these years, and we've touched a little bit on the reunions, but those have been a regular occurrence, and it seems like almost all the teammates that can participate in those, and that's, I would think, a great statement as to what a good team and a good relationship you had when you were in school. But tell me a little bit about the reunions and getting back together with these guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that kind of – we had a point guard by the name of Albert Faneuil. He lives down in Florida. And in 2010, we hadn't done anything prior to that, you know. We would always call. Everybody would call and check on individuals, how you doing and everything. And so Albert said, well, hey, why don't you guys come on down and let's get together? Well, that first year, 2010 – some folks made it, some didn't. They had a few people there. But the very next year, if you saw my introduction in my book, there was a power forward by the name of Bruce Hobson. Now, he lived in Dayton, Ohio. So he said, hey, we're going to get together and we're going to do this thing. And so He had it in his home, and the whole team made it. Everybody made it. We had such a great time telling them old war stories, and you just have to be a fly on the wall to sit in there to hear some of the stuff that went on and that they talked about and what we can laugh about. And so after that reunion, we would always get together and say, well, who's going to host it next year? And so the next year, someone else hosted it from a different city, and the next year someone hosted it. So we've been in Dayton, Florida. We went down to, we've been into Missouri. We've been to Alabama. We've been to Atlanta, Georgia, and we've been to Virginia Beach. We've been to Plano, Texas. So, because our guys are scattered out all over the country. And so, and each one will host it and make the arrangements, and guys would show up and support it. So, we did it up in Cleveland one time. Elmore Smith hosted one, and we went up there. And then, part of the entertainment, we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Oh, we had a great time there, you know. So, I mean, we did so much stuff. And had so much food, and it's just a real good time. You saw some of the pictures in the book.
Oh yes,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So we just had a marvelous time, just everybody getting back together, talking on, and we tell the same old stories. But every time you tell them, I mean, people hang on them, you know. Every time, you know, I know our wives probably get kind of tired of it, but we never do. We never get tired of telling the same old stories.
Yeah, you can't hear them too many times. You mentioned the book, and that it's called Still Champions After All These Years. Arthur Box wrote that about his era at Kentucky State and the years surrounding the time that he was there. I'm sure your teammates have great appreciation for that. It's just a fantastic compilation of those great years of basketball at Kentucky State. And now, you were telling me that it's out of print now, right? So it's not possible for folks to order a copy. Is it available online or digitally or anywhere where people might be able to take a look?
Not yet. It's not available yet, but I might have to work on that to get it, to make it available again. I tell you, when I wrote that book, I published it myself. I did all the legwork on it. It took me about 2 or 3 years. And, you know, I'm a pack rat. I never throw anything away. So I had all of the statistics. I had all of that stuff. And then I had to do some research on the guys' biographies because it's called Still Champions After All These Years. Those guys have gone on to do some great things in life, you know, outside of basketball, if you notice some of the things that they're doing. And that's why I came up with the title, because they're still championship quality type of persons, you know. But one of the other reasons that I wrote the book was the fact that Travis and Elmore, rightly so, they were superstars. I mean, it was a privilege to play with guys like that. But like I said, they would be the first ones to tell you that we were a team. And so I wanted to make sure that the people was aware of the contributions of all of the guys on the team, not just Travis and Elmore. And so that's why, you know, I went into detail with the managers and the cheerleaders. You know, the cheerleaders was the spirit of the team. You know, they traveled everywhere with us, and we really enjoyed it. It was like Coach Mitchell used to say, they used to put a spell on the other team. They were so good. And so, the information about all of those guys and their statistics and what they did in high school and when they graduated, and for the most part, only three guys from all of those teams didn't graduate. For the most part, we only had, well, everybody got their degree.
I was going to ask you about that because, yeah, a lot of guys did come back, even if they needed to come back later, came back and got their degrees. Many of them have gone into the education field themselves and have kind of given back in that sense, and Travis Grant was one of those, but they have succeeded in a variety of fields, as you said.
Yeah, Travis Gregg got his honorary doctorate degree from Kentucky State. He got his master's degree at West Georgia. Of course, he got his bachelor's of science at Kentucky State, you know. So with the exception of three guys, and the ironic part about it, all three of those guys are deceased now. They're not living anymore. But the point is that Coach Mitchell used to always tell us that it was books and basketball. That's the reason why you're here, books and basketball. And so that was our focus. And so we went to class. K-State was a stickler for education. Those teachers and professors, they weren't giving you no grades. I mean, you had to do the work. And so we really appreciate the education that we got from Kentucky State. And, of course, they've gone on to do such great things. You can see that the education paid off because of the things that those guys have done in their lives, you know. Jerome Brister, he was the director of Fannie Mae, one of those firms. He was a business major over at Kentucky State. Kentucky State at the time had one of the best business schools in the country. And so, he was a business major, and he went on to some great things. Of course, Elmore is a restaurateur. Mm-hmm. You know, William Graham has a master's degree, and he was the director of the Exum Center for a long time until he retired. He retired as a former athletic director, a former coach for Kentucky State, and a director of the Exum Center. So, I mean, these are great accomplishments for men, and all of those guys on the team. We have a lot of teachers, guys that went on to the education field. Charles Francis, for example, he was an educator. Carl Baldwin was an educator in Louisville, and so they've gone on to do some great things. And so that's why the book was entitled Steel Champions, because they are champions in life. And, we always wanted to give back. You know, my dad was concerned about me getting my degree because he wasn't a sports guy at all. And so he only had a fifth grade education. So he wanted to make sure that I got my education. So, and that's what I'm mostly proud of, is the information about the other guys too. I mean, Travis and Elmore, rightly so, they deserve everything they got because they were such great ball players, you know. You know how people talk about being in the presence of Michael Jordan and how they talked about playing with him and how great he was?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way that we felt about playing with Travis and Elmore, because I mean, guys like that, they don't come around all the time. You might have good players, but man, guys like Travis and Elmore, they don't come around all the time. And when they do, it's just really a privilege to play with them. You know, you see somebody hitting 60 points a night or something like that, and I mean, it was great just to watch them play, and that inspired you to get out there and do what you could do. You may not hit 60. But the 15 or 20 points that you did hit was contributing to the win. So that was just real important to us as a team.
Well, again, it's still champions after all these years, and the story continues as far as what these guys are doing in life, and Arthur Box was a big part of it back in the early 70s. Arthur, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today, and we appreciate you taking the time, and thanks for helping us get a further insight into a great era of basketball at Kentucky State.
Well, I appreciate it. I really enjoyed talking to you, just talking about the guys, and just really appreciating all the things that they've done, and just giving a thanks to Kentucky State University too. The HBCUs didn't get a lot of credit for the teams that we put on the floor, but people look back now and they tell us how great we were. And now that you're out of it and you look back on it, you say, yeah, I guess we was pretty good. you know, so, but I appreciate you talking to me.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.